1985.
Resuming our reading of Savitri, I would like to share with you an interesting knowledge that I received yesterday. You know, I believe in gathering knowledge from anybody, anywhere. My teacher had impressed upon me when I was very young, baladapi shukadapi, that is, you must garner knowledge from a child, even from a parrot. So I always keep my eyes open and ears open. And I met an old friend yesterday. Normally he tells me some interesting things. So I came out of my office when I saw him through the window. I said, "Why not tell me something today?" Then he said, "Yes." And he recited a couplet, whether it was Urdu or Persian, I'm not sure. Meaning was, the poet who writes it, he asks, "How many enemies am I going to kill? The number of evil people, the number of these enemies, they reach up to the sky. Is it possible for me to kill each of them? Instead of that, if I slay one anger in my heart, there is no enemy for me thereafter. That's the one enemy to be slain, and no enmity can exist thereafter." So that's the couplet. Then he said, he recited this couplet. At that time when he read it, he was in jail in the freedom movement. So his neighbor was a rustic practicing yoga asanas, practicing yoga, you can say, of the hatha yoga, you may say. So he told him this couplet and he appreciated it very much. Then he made an observation. He said, "Yes, that is true. You can't cover the whole of earth with leather. You can prepare sandals and cover your own shoes. And you can walk anywhere." Right? You understand the idea? It is impossible to cover the entire earth with leather. We cover our own feet with leather. He is a rustic. And that has been haunting me since yesterday. I am going to write about it. But you will read it only after some months. So I was impatient to share it with you all. And I do hope it will make some difference. Keep this imagery, not so much about the slaying of anger in the heart, but about the leather. We can't change the world, we can't reform the world, but we can put ourselves in a position when the world will no longer need to be reformed for our experience. We will see only those sides of life which express something of God and not the devil. So, that done, we will now resume our study. We were in a portion where there is a cry from below and a reply from above. And the reply was, for the simple reason, that even below, that oneness, that divinity dwells in the depths of the cosmos. Speaking of that boundless oneness, he continues, to its own sight unrecognizable, it lived still sunk in its own tenebrous seas. That oneness, that consciousness, has become so much involved, so much change in form, that it can't recognize itself. And it is has plunged itself in the dark waters of inconscience. And what is it doing there? Upholding the world's inconscient unity, hidden in matter's insentient multitude. There is a unity supporting this unconscious multitude in matter's world, and that unity is upheld by this oneness. Otherwise, things would be completely split up. This seed self, sown in the indeterminate seed self of the divine consciousness, planted in the indeterminate mass, forfeit its glory of divinity. Outwardly it is not, it doesn't have that splendor, that glory which we normally associate with the divine consciousness, divine being, forfeits its glory of divinity, concealing the omnipotence of its force. The divine consciousness is omnipotent, but here, at this inconscient level, it conceals. It behaves as if it is limited. It is not all-powerful, concealing the omniscience of its soul, knowledge. It behaves as if it is caught up in ignorance, searching for knowledge. But, he says, an agent of its own transcendent will. It is still an agent, a transmitting agent, of the transcendent will. It merges knowledge in the inconscient deep. It is the transcendent will that knowledge must merge in inconscience, and from there emerge in a changed form, accepting error, sorrow, death and pain. It pays the ransom of the ignorant night, redeeming by its substance nature's fall. Now, nature in its plunge downwards has fallen into inconscience. And this divine being, or the divine substance or consciousness, redeems nature. But in the process, it pays the price of accepting the hospitality of the ignorant night. And what's the price? Accepting error, sorrow, death and pain. These are things which are there because they have been accepted by the divine being which has involved itself, plunged itself into inconscience. And Ashwapati himself, he knew and why his soul had gone into earth's passionate obscurity. Ashwapati becomes aware of his own existence, the reason why his soul had plunged into the obscurity, intense obscurity of earth, and what's that purpose, what's that reason? To share the labor of an errant power, the power that moves from position, status to status. It is in labor to produce a divine manifestation, and he realizes that his soul had gone into this obscurity in order to participate in the labor of this power. Errant does not mean making mistakes, but moving, not static, which by division hopes to find the one, the power that is at work, first divides, and it hopes to find the one in the division. One by itself, there is no wonder if you find the one. But in the many, in the multiplicity, if you are able to discover the one, that is a miracle. And that is the game. That, and in that game, his soul has come to share the labor. Two beings he was, it applies to all of us in our conscious moments, he says, two beings he was, one wide and free above, one struggling, bound, intense its portion here. Here, you will recall the famous passage in the Upanishads, the Vedas, and repeated in other scriptures, that two birds on a common tree, one bird is above watching below, and on the same tree on a lower branch there is another bird which has eaten the fruit of that tree, and it is seized with sorrow, it is suffering, it is in pain. But the moment it looks up to the bird above, then its sorrow goes, because it realizes that is itself. Till then, the higher bird above goes on looking at the lower bird, hoping that it will look up. So that's the secret of God being more anxious for us than we are for him. That's also the meaning of the saying that you take one step and God takes two steps. So the being, the bird above, is always watching with concern. And the moment the lower bird looks up, it realizes its identity and grief goes away. Sri Aurobindo refers to this imagery in many places, in his translations of the Upanishads and in the other Life Divine and other passages. And it is a good, it is a popular theme among many artists to paint. It is not only in the Indian tradition, I believe in some other traditions also. These two birds on one tree is a popular theme. Two beings he was, one wide and free above, one struggling, bound, intense its portion here. a tie between them still could bridge two worlds. A tie, a bridge, a link between our being lost in nature and suffering here, and that part of our being which is free, wide. If we can somehow forge a path, a link, well, that can make common passage from one world to the other. Heaven and earth could be bridged if we can restore unity between our higher self and the lower self. And all yoga, at least in its earlier phases, is intended to build this bridge. We are at the moment divided beings. Even our nature is divided, lower nature and higher nature, para prakriti and apara prakriti. If we leave things as they are, we arrive nowhere. But if we take steps to fuse both into one, to make the lower acquire the nature of the higher, and that is by eliminating from itself movements and qualities which are alien to the higher nature, then automatically the lower nature changes its character and approaches something nearer the intrinsic quality of being of the higher nature. And gradually, no lower nature is left. All becomes higher nature, and the distinction between lower and higher is no longer valid. There is only one nature, and that is a transformed divine nature. Well, a tie between them still could bridge two worlds. There was a dimmed response. A distant breath. Here the poet now comes to the scene. There is a response from above. A dim. It is not very clear. It is not very articulate. It is dim. A distant breath. He feels the breath from above, but it is far. It is distant. All had not ceased in the unbounded hush. Around him, all was in hush, suspension. But all had not stopped breathing. That is, all was not dead. There was some movement. There was some stir still. His heart lay somewhere, conscious and alone, far down below him, like a lamp in light. From the height where he is there, he is looking down, and his heart he sees down, down below, conscious, but alone, separated from everything else, like a lamp in light. In night, in the darkness of night, just as a solitary lamp glows, so he sees his heart lying somewhere below, conscious and alone. Abandoned it lay, alone, imperishable, immobile, with excess of passionate will. It has so much of intensity of aspiration, intensity of prayer for the higher world to come down, that will has become immobile, things have become like a statue. He is living, sacrificed and offered heart, absorbed in adoration, mystical. Now here, these are three adjectives of the heart. It describes the heart. It is a living heart, a sacrificed heart, and an offered heart. And it is absorbed in mystical adoration of the divine power. And that love, he says, turned to its far-off fount of light and love. He watches his heart. That heart is described, and it is turned above to that far-off source of light and love. In the luminous stillness of its mute appeal, it is appealing, but not speaking. It is a silent appeal. And in that luminous stillness, it looked up to the heights it could not see. It yearned from the longing depths it could not leave. It could not leave these depths where it is plunged. And their longing depths, longing for the higher influx, from there it yearns, it passionately desires. In the center of its vast and fateful trance, halfway between his free and fallen selves, interceding twixt God's day and the mortal's night. Day refers to the luminous consciousness and night to the obscure consciousness. Accepting worship as its single law, it is the heart. Accepting worship as its single law, accepting bliss as the sole cause of things, refusing the austere joy that which none can share. It refused to be spiritually selfish. It refused to enjoy the bliss alone. That is, it rejected the option of the ascetic. It did not care for joy which it could not share with all. Refusing the austere joy which none can share, refusing the calm that lives for calm alone. Calm. Now that calm, if it lives for calm alone, concerned only with itself, concerned only with safeguarding itself, it can very well remain that for eternity. But his heart didn't want that. That calm has to relate itself to the world, to the movement in the world. It has to support it. Refusing the calm that lives for calm alone, to her it turned, for whom it willed to be. His heart continues to exist, wills to live for her, and it turned to her. In the passion of its solitary dream, it lay like a closed, soundless oratory. Oratory is that hall in the church where people assemble and offer their prayers to Jesus Christ. It lay like a closed, soundless oratory where sleeps a consecrated, argent floor, where the silvery floor, paved floor of the ground. It is consecrated because there the prayers are offered. When people are not there, it is still, it has an atmosphere of its own. Where sleeps a consecrated argent floor, lit by a single and untrembling ray, and An invisible presence kneels in prayer. There, in that oratory, on the argent floor which is consecrated, lit by a single steady ray from God, a presence which cannot be seen physically, but certainly it can be felt, kneels in prayer. It is the divine presence which moves those who come to pray. And even when people are not there, an invisible presence kneels in prayer. On some deep breast of liberating peace, all else was satisfied with a quietude. Around this surrendered heart of Vashopati, there breathed a liberating peace, and everything was satisfied. Satisfied with that silence, satisfied with that quietude. This only knew, only his heart was conscious and knew there was a truth beyond. All other parts were dumb in centered sleep. All other limbs, all other parts of his being were in trance and they were dumb, consenting to this low, deliberate power. That means they had accepted the rule of the reigning power in the universe, which tolerates the world's error and grief, consenting to the cosmic long delay, timelessly waiting through the patient years. That is the deliberate and slow power. It is bearing. It is consenting to the delay, timelessly waits through the patient years. Her coming they had asked for earth and men. The power at work on earth is waiting with patience for the coming of the Divine Mother, which they had asked, all the beings had asked for earth and men. His other parts, I'm sorry, all of the parts of Ashwapati who had prayed for her coming, they had gone into trance of waiting, accepting the will of the reigning power to wait and wait. Only his heart was impatient, the central part of him was impatient. This was the fiery point that called her now. His heart, calling, intensely calling heart, was the fiery point which exerted the pull which called the Divine Mother now. Extinction could not quench that lonely fire. The trance-like extinction of all the parts could not quench that fire which was burning in his heart. Its seeing filled the blank of mind and will. Mind and will were blank, but the vision of the fire, heart, was filling. Thought dead. Thought was dead. Its changeless force abode and grew. Though the thought, as thought had died, the force of that thought still lived on and grew. Armed with the intuition of a bliss, there was an intuitive perception that there is a bliss above, to which some mood tranquility was the key. But that bliss cannot be secured unless you have established a certain tranquil poise in yourself. That is the key to the bliss above. Armed with the intuition of a bliss to which some mood tranquility was the key, it persevered through life's huge emptiness, his heart continues to wait with faith amid the blank denials of voiceless prayer to the unknown. It listened for the steps of its hopes, returning through the void immensities. Its own hopes, they are now returning. It waits to listen to that. It is listening through the blank immensities. Its hopes are returning with what they have hoped for. It waited for the fire to the world. It waited for the decree of the word of God that comes through the still self from the supreme. That fire to the world, that sanction, that final order comes through the still self. You come to listen to that word, to that fiat through the still self. It comes from the supreme, no doubt, but it emerges. You don't hear it from the sky, but it emerges through your own self, and that self has to be still. It shall not be agitated, it shall not be impatient, it shall not be intensely involved, but still, patiently waiting. And when that self is still, it is the door through which the word from God emerges, and Ashwapati's heart is listening to the footsteps of the hopes returning and waits for that word. That word is not yet. Next time we take next canto, the vision in the boon.